K-Mud Podcast presents.
Good morning and welcome to Heart of the Earth. This is a program about Native Americans and other indigenous cultures. My name is Agnes. I opened with Pipestone Creek. Pipestone, and it's honoring art. Well, last year when I was watching a special on Sitting Bull, boy, I pretty sure it was on the History Channel, but I really can't remember. But when they were talking about the Battle of Little Bighorn, which I'm going to really focus on next week because that's the anniversary, but they really talked about, you know, a battle that happened 8 days before, and it's really not talked a lot about, and that's really what, you know, led up to the victory 8 days later. So I thought I'd share a little bit about that today with you, because on today, the 17th of June, 2026, the Northern Cheyenne, Lakota, Arapaho, and their allies will return to the Wolf Mountains for a full day of remembrance, marking the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Rosebud. The battle the Cheyenne called Where the Girl Saved Her Brother. The commemoration will begin early, long before the formal programs open. At 8 a.m., which it has already happened, riders will leave Trail Creek on horseback, following the same route their ancestors traveled into the valley 150 years ago. By 1 p.m., they are expected to arrive at the Rosebud Battlefield State Park, where they will join the public program for reenactment of Buffalo Calf Road Woman's rescue of her brother comes in sight. A victory dance will follow at 2 p.m. with a community feast at 3. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks announced that the public is invited to attend the full day of events, which also includes morning ceremonies beginning at 10 a.m., featuring prayers, a wreath laying, and a keynote address by Dr. Leo Kilsback, Northern Cheyenne, an historian, author, and one of the leading contemporary voices on Cheyenne history and sovereignty. For many Native families, the commemoration is not simply an historical observance. It is a homecoming. Although the Battle of Rosebud is often overshadowed by the Battle of Little Bighorn 8 days later, historians say the Rosebud was the moment the Native nations seized the initiative in the 1876 campaign. It was on June 17, 1876, Brigadier George Crook led roughly 1,000 U.S. soldiers and scouts north into the Wolf Mountains. Waiting for him was a combined Native force of Lakota, Northern Cheyenne, and Arapaho warriors, estimated between 750 and 1,000 fighters. They had gathered for the great summer encampment and had agreed they would not wait to be attacked. They would meet Crook on the Rosebud and stop him before he reached the Little Bighorn Valley, where thousands of Native families were camped. The Native leaders included Crazy Horse, the Oglala war leader, Crow King, and other Hunkpapa elders, Humptu, Spotted Eagle, and the disciplined Minnecoho, and the Northern Cheyenne chiefs, Two Moon, Young Two Moon, Spotted Wolf, Brave Wolf, and Lame White Man. A small but divisive Arapaho contingent under Black Coal, Sharp Nose, and Yellow Calf also joined the fight. Their unity was not accidental. It was the result of years of shared struggle, shared grief, and shared determination to remain free. At dawn, the valley lay quiet. Lakota and Cheyenne warriors were already mounted, watching the dust of Crook's column rising from the south. They knew he was coming. They had chosen the ground, and they were ready. When Crook's scouts entered the valley, Crazy Horse struck first. He led a sudden downhill charge that shattered the morning stillness and forced the soldiers into a defensive scramble. Lakota and Cheyenne warriors poured over the ridges like water, firing from horseback, then wheeling away before the soldiers could form a steady line. Crook had expected shattered resistance. Instead, he found himself facing a coordinated Native army. The Northern Cheyenne fought with fierce precision, moving from ridge to ridge, firing down into soldiers who struggled to climb under fire. Two Moon later said the fighting rolled across the hills, quote, like waves, and that is how it felt, surges of warriors appearing suddenly on one flank, then disappearing, only to reappear on another. In the midst of this chaos came the moment that gave the battle its Cheyenne name. A warrior named Comes in Sight was shot from his horse and lay exposed as soldiers closed in. His sister, Buffalo Calf Road Woman, rode straight into the gunfire, pulled him onto her horse, and carried him to safety. Cheyenne warrior saw her and shouted, "The girl saved her brother." The cry spread across the field, lifting the hearts of the fighters. Her courage became the turning point of the day, igniting the Cheyenne line with renewed fury. Crazy Horse, seeing the momentum shift, executed one of his signature battlefield maneuvers. He led a wide flanking sweep around Crook's left, striking from the side and near. Hunkpapa and Minocoho soldiers followed with disciplined precision, pressing the soldiers so hard that Crook was forced to pull men from his center just to keep from being overrun. For eight hours, the battle raged across miles of broken country. By mid-afternoon, Crook's ammunition was running low. His Crow and Shoshone scouts were exhausted, and his infantry was pinned in the coulees. He could not advance. He could barely hold his position. Finally, he ordered a withdrawal south towards Goose Creek, ending any hope of joining other U.S. Army columns moving toward the Little Bighorn. That retreat changed the course of history. The U.S. government had planned a three-pronged campaign to trap the, quote, non-agency Lakota and Cheyenne. Crook was supposed to come from the south, Terry and Custer from the east, and Gibbon from the west. But after the Rosebud, Crook never rejoined the campaign. He rested, regrouped, and even went fishing in the Bighorn Mountains while the rest of the army moved on without him. 8 days later, when Custer rode down the bluffs of the Little Bighorn, he rode in alone. The warriors he faced there, Lakota, Northern Cheyenne, and Arapaho, were the same warriors who had beaten Crook. They were confident. They were unified. They were ready. The Battle of Rosebud was not a footnote to the Battle of Greasy Grass. It was the opening victory of the Native Summer Campaign of 1876. It was the day Crazy Horse, Two Moon, the Northern Cheyenne, the Hunkpapa, the Izapicto, and the Arapaho stood together and stopped an army. It was the day Buffalo Calf Road Woman rode into history, and it was the day the road to the Greasy Grass was set in motion, not by the U.S. Army, but by the warriors who fought to protect their people and their way of life. Although an estimated 750 to 1,000 Native warriors fought at Rosebud, only about 200 names survive in the historical record. They include from the Northern Cheyenne, the Two Moon Band, Lame White Man's Band, and Spotted Wolf's Band, the Oglala Lakota, Crazy Horse's Followers, He Dog Band, the Hunkpapa Lakota, Crow King's Warriors, Rain in the Face's Relatives, from the Minocoho Lakota Hump Twos Band, Touch the Clouds Relatives, the Lakota Spotted Eagles Contingent, the Arapaho Black Coles Contingent. The full, verified, and oral history warrior roles will be available at the commemoration and the event program. And as of today, tribal families say they are preparing not only to honor the past, but to stand on the same ground their ancestors defended. They will gather, they will ride in, they will speak the names that survived, and they will remember the hundreds more whose names were never written down, but whose courage shaped the history of the Northern Plains. The 150th anniversary of the Battle of Rosebud is not simply a commemoration. It is a return. And that was The Hallucination with some help from Northern Cree, giving us Babylon from their EP, Paths of the Baby Face. Oh, no, I think it was from A Path of the Heel. But there were two EPs that were put together. Well, last week I talked a little bit about Deb Holland, but I really appreciate Julie Francella's story about Deb, because I know when I see her and I know all that she represents, you know, my heart gets heavy with joy, and I can bring tears to my eyes of happiness of what this woman represents to Native country and all that she has done and all that she's sacrificed. So Julie says, when I heard that Deb Holland had won the Democratic nomination for governor of New Mexico, I thought first of the old women. I thought of the grandmothers who carried water in clay water jars, the women who braided children's hair before boarding school and residential schools cut their hair short, the aunties who stirred soup or wood on wood stoves while speaking a language they had once been punished for carrying in their mouths. I thought of how Indigenous women have always governed. Long before there were podiums and campaign signs, our women understood diplomacy. They understood kinship obligations. They understood that leadership was never meant to rise above the people, but to move among them like roots beneath the forest floor, holding everything together quietly where nobody could see. The maple tree does not announce itself while making sap. The river does not boast while carrying like life downstream, and yet both sustain entire worlds. Deb Holland is Laguna Pueblo. She is a 35th generation New Mexican. She has always carried history into rooms where Native women were never meant to stand. She was one of the first Native American women elected to Congress. Then she became the first Native American to serve as a U.S. Cabinet Secretary, leading the Department of the Interior. Because the Department of the Interior was never just another government office to us, it was tied to lands, treaties, removals, resource extraction, boarding schools, and the long bureaucratic machinery that tried to manage Native people instead of honoring Native nations. So when Deb Holland walked into that department as Secretary of the Interior, she was not simply taking a job. She was entering a building full of ghosts. There is something profound about seeing an Indigenous woman walk into institutions built during the long years of our attempted erasure, buildings raised on lands where our ancestors once gathered medicines and held ceremony, departments that signed papers dividing territories they could never truly own. I don't think the tragic history disappears because one Native woman enters those spaces. The land remembers too well for that. But perhaps history bends a little. Perhaps the doors open differently now. In The New Yorker, Holland said something that feels like the heart of this whole moment. Quote, when I think about why I'm really here, she says, quote, it's like I'm here because the ancestors felt it was necessary. We call that blood memory. Because when an Indigenous woman enters a room like that, she does not enter it alone. She carries the grandmothers, the children, the languages, the ceremonies, the songs nearly silenced and still somehow sung. She carries the people who were never invited into those buildings, but whose lives were shaped by every decision made inside them. She carries the ancestors who were treated as obstacles to settlement, wards of the state, subjects of policy, and problems to be solved. So when Holland walked into the Department of the Interior, she was not simply making history. She was bringing history with her. A Pueblo woman standing inside a federal agency that had helped oversee so much Native disposition and saying, in effect, we remember. And then she did something even more important than making history. She made the government look at itself. And I want to interject here because I will never forget when she had the confirmation hearings and what some of those Republican senators said to her. I mean, she, you know, it was just so disparaging. And she just sat there, you know, held her head high and, you know, just let it brush off and just, you know, was so firm in her answers that there was no way they could not, you know, confirm her. But to continue, she made the government look at itself. As Secretary of the Interior, Holland launched the Feral Indian Boarding School Initiative, the first comprehensive federal effort to investigate the boarding school system in the United States. That mattered not only politically, but personally. Her own family, like so many of ours, carried the wounds of those schools. Her grandparents were taken as children, so when she spoke about boarding schools, she was not speaking from a policy memo. She was speaking from blood memory. For generations, Native families carried those stories in silence, grief, anger, and survival. Children taken, hair cut, languages punished, names replaced, families left to stitch themselves back together without apology, records, or answers. Under Holland's leadership, the Interior Department began documenting the schools, the graves, the records, the money, the churches, the laws, and the machinery that made Native children removal possible. She created the Road to Healing Tour, where survivors and their descendants were invited to speak directly to the federal government, often for the first time. Think about that for a moment. Generations of Native families had carried these stories in kitchens, ceremonies, treatment rooms, community halls, and quiet private grief. And then at last, the government had to sit down and listen. At least it was something. It doesn't heal everything. It doesn't return every child. It doesn't erase the sound of doors closing behind little ones who should have been home, hearing their own languages, eating their own food, sleeping near the people who loved them. But it interprets the lie that history is over. Holland's work at Interior reached beyond the boarding school investigation. She created a missing and murdered unit within the Bureau of Indian Affairs to address the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous people. She moved to remove a racist slur against Native women from federal place names. She supported bison restoration and helped push conversations about public lands toward tribal consultation, conservation, and Indigenous stewardship. None of this fixes history, but it does something. It places Native life back into the record. It says our grief is not folklore. Our land is not empty. Our women are not disposable. Our children were not unfortunate footnotes in some distant chapter of American progress. They were loved. They were stolen. They were mourned. They are remembered. This is part of what Holland carried into the Interior Department, memory. And memory, when held properly, can become a form of accountability. With her victory in the New Mexico Democratic primary, Deb Holland stands at the edge of another possible first. If elected governor in November, she would become the first Native American woman ever elected to govern a U.S. state. That is not a small thing. Representation alone will not return land, clean poisoned water, protect every sacred place, or undo centuries of federal violence. We know better than to confuse symbolism with justice. But symbols can still carry medicine, especially when they are attached to someone who knows what it means to come from a people, not just speak for one. Someone who has known struggle as a single mother, someone who has moved through public life with Pueblo roots, military, family discipline, organizing experience, and the kind of steadiness that does not need to perform power to possess it. I think many Indigenous people recognize that feeling watching Deb Holland. Not triumph exactly. Recognition. The recognition that despite every policy meant to disappear us, we are still producing leaders rooted in community and memory. We are still raising daughters who know how to carry both tenderness and strength together in the same hands. Colonial systems often measure power through domination, through extraction, through how much we can be owned, controlled, fenced, or consumed. but many Indigenous teachings ask a different question altogether. How well did you care for what was entrusted to you? The water, the children, the stories, the animals, one another. Perhaps that is why this moment feels significant to so many of us, because Indigenous leadership carries with it another way of imagining responsibility. Leadership is not supposed to be a performance of importance. It is supposed to be a practice of care. That idea feels almost radical in a country that keeps confusing cruelty with strength and wealth with wisdom. I have to just read that again to make sure you understand this. The idea feels almost radical in a country that keeps confusing cruelty with strength and wealth with wisdom. But our people have known this for a long time. You do not prove your power by how much you can take. You prove it by what you are willing to protect. In our teachings, we are reminded that all things carry spirit, even wounded things, even places burdened by difficult memories, especially those places. Healing does not arrive all at once like thunder. More often it comes the way spring arrives in the north, slowly and patiently. First a thaw beneath the surface, then water moving under ice, then spring plant shoots pushing upward where everything once appeared barren. That's what this moment feels like to me, a thaw, a shift, a door opening in a place where our ancestors were once considered the enemy of this country. I wonder sometimes what our ancestors would think seeing Native women standing at the center of rooms where decisions about land and water are made. I wonder if they would grieve the cost of what was lost to get here. I wonder if they would smile knowing the song survived anyway. Likely both. Our people understand that joy and grief often travel together. We know what it means to laugh at the kitchen table after a funeral. We know how to tell jokes in the middle of disaster. We know how to carry heartbreak and still make soup, still braid hair, still light the fire, still show up. That is survival too. And maybe that is what I felt hearing the news about Deb Haaland, like the first warm wind after a hard winter. Deb Haaland's victory doesn't end the work. It doesn't undo the laws, the removals, the hunger, the schools, the graves, the maps, the lies. But it does remind us of something powerful. The systems built to erase us are now being entered by the very people they failed to disappear and bury. And when Deb Haaland says she is there because the ancestors felt it was necessary, we all believe her. Because something reckoning doesn't move like a tornado. Sometimes it moves like water under ice. Sometimes it moves through women who carry clay jars, stories, grief, laughter, and entire nations in their hands. Sometimes it walks into a building full of ghosts and refuses to be haunted into silence. A reminder from the ancestors. We are still here.
spirits come down to dance the heaven and earth. Hear their call, sing your songs, awaken. Hear the whispers of your soul. Water of life, flesh, blood, fire, rain, purification, creation. Who am I, Anishinaabe? Who am I, all nations? If you listen to the earth with your heart, you'll hear the dreams of our ancestors.
And that was Keith Sekola, the title cut from his CD, For Our Ancestors. Well, as a photographer, I follow different Native photographers. Carl Romero comes to my mind, Tape, Makita Wilbur, Tomas Carmelo, and also Joe Whittle, and most of them just write incredible stories to go along with their photography. And this is something that Joe, a piece he did for Huffington Post, and it's entitled "Protecting Oklahoma's Wildlife Means Honoring My Ancestors' Relationship with the Land." And he says, "The last place I expected to find one of the oldest mountain ranges in the United States or its first national wildlife refuge was in southwestern Oklahoma. Rising out of the prairie like spines on an alligator cresting the still surface of a backwater bayou, the Wichita Mountains are an oasis of craggy peaks and shimmering lakes, harboring some of America's most iconic wildlife. There, one can find majestic herds of bison and elk grazing golden native grasslands, iridescent turkey feathers, and snow-white deer tails flickering among quiet forest, crystalline streams under crimson canyon walls to cast a line into, and mountaintop pools home to flora and fauna found nowhere else in the planet, just to name a few of its wild wonders. What a surprise it was to encounter this ancient, otherworldly mountain range making its home on the smooth southern plains of North America, only an hour away from my own home in Chickasaw, Oklahoma. I was inspired to move to Chickasaw 3 years ago to be closer to my daughter, River, who'd moved to Oklahoma herself to work for our tribe, the Caddo Nation. Neither of us grew up in Oklahoma, where my Caddo Delaware father was born. Rather, we were born near another ancient mountain range in northeastern Oregon called the Walloa Mountains. They are home to another indigenous people, Chief Joseph's band of Nez Perce, who are infamously forced out by a cruel war of settler expansion. My father chose to name me Joseph out of respect for that history and people, and I grew up to love and respect them and their beautiful wild homeland. My love for the land eventually led me to serve as a backcountry wilderness ranger for the U.S. Forest Service there. As I learned more about my own and other indigenous cultures, I came to understand that it's our sacred connection with nature and the ecologies that support us that allowed our people to thrive for so many countless millennia on this continent, and I came to depend on that connection as an essential part of my identity and well-being. I never imagined moving to southwestern Oklahoma before the moment I decided to. Based on my infrequent visits for family and tribal events, I viewed the seemingly monotonous terrain there as uninviting and considered to be a place where the most connection one could find with nature would be a farmer's field. Both of our tribes were ethnically cleansed from our original homelands in the eastern and southeastern woodlands and sent to live within a very different ecology than the ones that formed our indigenous identities. Oklahoma was a landscape I felt forced to connect with by circumstance rather than a desire to. That day, until the fateful day, I was talking on the phone with River and she said, "Dad, you should move here too." Before the words were out of her mouth, I knew that I was going to do it. It wasn't simply to be closer to my only child and hopefully grandchildren someday, but because I knew that our tribal communities need our people in them, learning and helping preserve our culture, history, and traditions. Part of the deal I made with myself when I decided to give up access to the wild spaces I loved to be close to my tribe and daughter was that I would return to Oregon every summer to work at my seasonal wilderness ranger job and get caught up on my wilderness medicine then. So I figured it would all balance out. That balance worked well at first, and I enjoyed being able to slip into hibernation mode in a milder climate during winter until the wilderness ranger program was defunded and I lost my job to politics after 12 years of service to the land. Last summer was my first in over a decade not serving as a real ranger, though through a grant from the Oregon Community Foundation, I was able to go back and serve as a volunteer ranger, however, because the land needs care whether the government will pay for it or not. But returning home to Oklahoma after that, with no guarantee I'd be able to do it again, I was forced to face the idea that I could lose all access to the wild spaces essential to my well-being. That awareness, combined with the trajectory of the nation and its beleaguered ecologies, economic stress, and anxiety about the state of the world, left me in a dark place last fall, and I was feeling like I'd find little respite in the arms of nature now that I was cut off from the wilderness locations I depended on for so long. Then one day, I remembered that the Wichita Mountains National Wildlife Refuge lies only an hour away from me. I first learned that the refuge played a major role in preserving America's natural heritage while watching a Ken Burns documentary about the history of the American bison. When I heard it mentioned, my ears perked up, and I remembered my cousin telling me that I needed to visit the place. I was astounded to learn that not only is it the oldest national wildlife refuge in the United States, but it was instructional in saving American bison from extinction. I was also surprised to learn of the role indigenous people played in preserving bison in the refuge. It was created within the homelands of the Wichita tribe, which later became part of the Anadarko Indian Agency jurisdiction for Kiowa, Comanche, Apache, Wichita, Caddo, and Delaware people, each having their own region of the jurisdiction. located nearby to facilitate the U.S.-Indian wars on the Southern Plain and the forced relocation of the aforementioned tribes to their reservation lands lies Fort Sill, where the legendary Apache leader Geronimo was imprisoned. It's now home to the U.S. Army's premier field artillery training range. As part of the United States' wars of attrition against Native Americans in the West, they undertook the wholesale slaughter of the American bison, a primary food source for the tribes of the Great Plains and Rocky Mountains West. By the time the refuge was created in 1901, bison had become functionally extinct in the wild. While meeting Teddy Roosevelt in Washington, D.C., Comanche Chief Quanah Parker, a former enemy of the United States and the last Comanche war leader to move to the reservation, convinced Roosevelt, known for his racist attitude toward Native Americans, to visit the Wichita Mountains for a hunting trip. The president stayed at Parker's house and slept outdoors on his veranda and toured and hunted the mountains with him. After the visit, Roosevelt decided to create a wildlife preserve there, quote, for the protection of the game animals and birds, and should be recognized as a breeding place thereof. In addition, he facilitated the return of 15 bison to the refuge. It was the first federal effort to reintroduce them to their homelands and save them from extinction in the wild. The bison traveled by train halfway across the continent from the Bronx Zoo, where some of the last purebred members of the species were kept. Barker and other native people were present when they first stepped foot back into the prairie grasslands where they belong, and it is said he cried at the sight of it. The imposing presence of those bison in the refuge now became startlingly clear to me upon entering it for the first time. As I drove around a bend, I saw a massive bull towering over my car just off the road, free and unrestrained to roam where he pleased. I could have sworn I'd driven around the corner into Yellowstone, not the little-known Oklahoma Wildlife Refuge just down the road from me. Soon I discovered that four of the most important animals in Native American history reside in the refuge: buffalo, elk, deer, and turkeys, all central to Native American identity and subsistence. In fact, many of the native species originally present on that land have been returned or remained there. It's not just animal species thriving there. Expansive swaths of native grasslands and timberland fill the refuge as well. And there's even two kinds of plants and a type of fairy shrimp who make their homes in this region and nowhere else. Topping all of that off, the Wichitas contain some of the most unique geology on the continent. Moving from the unbelievably picturesque and dramatic landscape of northeastern Oregon to the endless horizon of southwestern Oklahoma is teaching me that every wonder of the world is equally wondrous. It's just a matter of learning to see them for their own true beauty and worth. Who's to say that a mere handful of the red earth nourishing the Oklahoma prairie isn't equal in beauty to the tallest mountain on the planet? Certainly there are species native to that earth who can't see it any other way. I am realizing the peaks are pointing back to the unassuming prairies below them and learning to see what they want me to see there. Who better to help me understand the deep lessons this landscape has to teach than the Wichita people who've been here the longest? So I asked my friend Robin Williams of Wichita, Caddo, Comanche Nations, who is the Historic Preservation Administrator for the Wichita and affiliated tribes, if she would share her people's history with the Wichita Mountains. Robin explained how that tribal origin stories describe their people emerging from the Wichita Mountains. Quote, through our elders, our language, and the land itself, we understand that we have been here on the southern plains beyond memory, existing as many closely related groups living across a broad landscape and sharing ways of life, kinship, and language. No matter how far we moved within our homelands, our origins remain tied to the Wichita Mountains, she continued. Quote, our name for them translates to our mountains, and many losses and challenges, attempted genocide, and much more, the Wichita people remain, just as the Wichita Mountains do. Our connection to them never left us. It continues through prayer, memory, story, and identity. Today, we continue to be grounded in this land, in our mountains, and in moving forward for the good of all our people. I was reminded by Robin's words that every ecology on the planet is home to a host of native species who cannot separate their own identity from it, and that each ecology and landscape is as unique and beautiful as the next, even if it seems foreign or uninviting at first. That just means we do not understand it yet, a lesson we can also apply to each other. Human beings are a native species on this planet, yet even our efforts to conserve nature, we can forget that, imagining ourselves as something separate from it. But conserving nature for nature's sake isn't about separating ourselves from it, but rather the way in which we engage with it. Respect for nature starts with the way we think about it. When we find the right perspective, the rest follows. If we treat nature with respect it deserves, we do not have to gatekeep or be intimidated by it. Remembering that we are as much a part of nature as any other species grows into understanding that respect for nature is respect for self. Indigenous societies who view themselves as having emerged from the land itself and being wholly defined by it understand that sustainable engagement with nature is about self-respect as well as outward respect. Witnessing Robin's profound respect for the Southern Plains and the deep layers of history contained in the land there inspired me to continue my journey connecting with this still foreign but growing into something welcoming and wondrous landscape. Oklahoma is known for its spectacular sunsets. This one is reflecting off Caddo Lake, named after my tribe, the Caddo, who are one of the seven tribes in this BIA jurisdiction. This was what was under a picture, and I just wanted to share what he said. It was a beautiful, beautiful photo. But he says, my Caddo great-great-great-grandmother Mary arrived here from her homelands in Louisiana on the Trail of Tears. She brought her son Willie at 6 years old and his infant brother, who died of exposure on the trail. He says, I may return to being a seasonal ranger someday, or better yet, the Indigenous Conservation Corps I am helping to create, called the Natural Law Conservation Corps, with crews of Indigenous conservationists applying traditional ecological knowledge to public land management. It is, I believe, a more sustainable solution than relying on the whims and chaos of politics and industry to decide the fate of the land. Wherever I end up doing or wherever I go, one thing I now understand is that my appreciation for all that the Southern Plains have to offer will continue to grow, and I will continue to see myself as more and more a part of them. Perhaps one day I'll see this land the way that my ancestors saw it. They adapted to it and became a part of it much more readily than I, even though they arrived here under unthinkably more difficult circumstances. Thanks to their sacrifices, we can honor the relationship they formed with this land and carry it forward today.
Hey,
that is a Kiowa slow dance, slow war dance song. I'll be back next week.
We have to learn to maneuver through a linear society without completely losing ourselves in that greed. In my language, Naholo, a lover of things.
Traditions, ancient knowledge in our hands, lighting sacred fires, sustaining song and dance, enduring all oppression we withstand. This is a song of survival. Can you get with this indigenous revival? A movement of the people, a revolution tribal, just another song of survival.
Yeah, you say you just live in life, but you remember where you're from. Do you acknowledge all your ancestors and the children yet to come? Have you gained or retained the knowledge that the old ones hold as sacred? The teachings of how to walk in balance, see clearly and release hatred. Why do we emulate what's popular in a society that wasn't built for us, or even with us in mind? So why do we participate in what's killing us? This one's for the artists, the poets, and our followers saving us. The b-boys and grappers, MCs and turntablists. The four elements are like medicine, a cultural empowerment. So keep your YOLO and swag and watch hip-hop devour it. The criticisms out of love for the things I know could be better. Ceremony is the key that unlocks knowledge beyond measure. See, I conjecture, we're changing the weather. Revolutionaries are doing feathers that have never been idle, manifesting coup through lectures. Colonization, assimilation, try to erase us from this nation, but we stand here strong, singing songs of creation.
Raising up our fists,
raising up our fists,
reaching for the stars,
reaching for the stars.
Defiant, we resist,
defiant, we resist.
Remember who we are,
remember who we are.
We are a people of endurance and protectors of the land, maintaining our traditions, ancient knowledge in our hands. Lighting sacred fires, sustaining song and dance, enduring all oppression we withstand. This is a song of survival. Can you get with this indigenous revival? A movement of the people, a revolution tribal, just another song of survival.
Spirit over money, teachings over law, balance over power, yeah, the empire shall fall. Manifest destiny, capitalist exploitation of nature, self-destructive destiny, manifested through hatred. Be careful, you can become this, don't take this out of context. Impotent rebellion stemming from an inferiority complex. Young one, do what you want, please don't get defensive. Just know what you put in the world has definitive consequences. Change, activist, action is the start. Not by the movement of your mouth, but the manifestation of your heart. People say that they don't see us, there's no evidence we're here. But when they look at us, they don't see us, they're only seeing their own fear. No Eiffel Tower here, no ancient towers, none. But listen for our heartbeat, you can hear it in the drum. You can see us in the land, where you stand is where we're from. Been regaining ancient knowledge, and the best is yet to come.
Raising up our fists,
raising up our fists,
reaching for the stars,
reaching for the stars.
Defiant, we resist,
defiant, we resist.
Remember who we are,
remember who we are.
We are a people of endurance and protectors of the land, maintaining our traditions, ancient knowledge in our hands. Lighting sacred fires, sustaining song and dance, enduring all oppression we withstand. This is a song of survival. Can you get with this indigenous revival? A movement of the people, a revolution tribal, just another song of survival.
This has been a K-Mite podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.